You're human.
Barely. I'm a lawyer.
I know a lot about the law and various other lawyerings. I'm well-educated, well-versed.
It's a thorny legal issue, all right. I'll need to refer to the case of Finders versus Keepers.
Isn't it true that you have been paid for your testimony?
Yes, you gave me a dollar and some candy.
And yet you haven't said what I told you to say. How can any of us trust you?
How can you be so sure?
Because I was saying to myself, where could he be going at 5 to 7 with that sawed-off shotgun?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 672. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew Torres. How are you doing, sir?
Hi. Just survive the stormpocalypse of Northern California.
Yeah. So obviously people know we recorded the last episode a bit early because there was, you know, talk of blizzard.
To a quote, bomb cyclone.
Yeah. And it was not that bomb, I got to say. It was that this storm left this reviewer cold or not cold, not cold enough. No, it was windy. But yeah. It was a bit like when in the Australia Simpsons episode, the best one probably of all of them, and for my money, when he's like, "Oh, I heard you have those giant beers here," and the bartender plops down an enormous beer, and Homer goes, "Oh, I guess it's pretty big."
You're saying the Australia episode is the best
that
episode of the
might
Simpsons
be my
period?
Favorite episode of the Simpsons. Wow, it's so good. Go back and watch. It is so funny. It is. Oh, it's really good. But anyway, yeah, we were all like prepping. I turned into a real prepper. I got some like, you know, because I had the power outage forever. And I was like, well, I need to do what I can about this, which isn't much in the short term. Because all the important stuff is I need like a house battery. Some people have that. I want to get that.
Yeah.
But so I got like lighting. I got like some, you know, some extra lights because the kids, you know, they actually love doing the flashlights and stuff. I was like, oh, I'll get a couple extra lights that they can do and all that. And then when you do a certain amount of prepping, you're disappointed when tragedy doesn't strike. You're like, damn it, there, nothing happened. And I feel like that's good insight into a lot of the right wing of our country. Like, they're probably always prepping for, like, civil war, you know, apocalypse crap, and then disappointed that it isn't happening. I think that's a lot of the voters in our country.
Always prepping for civil war, never doing something like electing a speaker. But
there we go. It's never not funny.
It is never not funny.
But we shouldn't talk about it. We're in the past. We're stuck in the past. We shouldn't talk about that because who knows what will have happened by
then.
Let's talk about what we do want to talk about today, which is an update on a certain weirdo that you had teased us about.
Yeah, so I have now been through all of Sidney Powell's testimony before the January 6th committee. I shared some of that with you last week. As part of that, I talked about her truly insane professed beliefs, right? And I have to tell you, after having read 172 pages of Sidney Powell answering questions, I don't know if she sincerely believes this nonsense or is just a tremendous bullshit.
I'll tell you, my read on her has been that she does believe it. That's been what I've thought, but I'm not, you know, that's just my opinion, man. Wherever you landed on that now, you genuinely can't tell.
Here are a couple of pieces of evidence just to kind of throw into the pot. The first thing, and I think because this is going to contrast very, very nicely with Tuesday's deep dive. The first is at the hearing, at the January 6th hearing, Sidney Powell was represented by counsel, and she was represented by David Tobin of McDermott, Will & Emery. And if you haven't heard of McDermott, Will & Emery, they're a coat factory law firm, right? They are one of the, I don't know, 20, 50 top, you know, big firms in the world. Very, very respectable. This guy, David Tobin, is an IP lawyer and not a stopping you from committing perjury before Congress lawyer. But like, she's paying him $2,000 an hour, right? Wow. Like, this is a real lawyer. He's younger. He just made partner, but like, he just made partner at a huge,
at a place where it's really good to make partner at.
Yeah. He's making millions right now, right? Like, as a young partner, maybe he's not quite there yet, but he's not eating salmon out of the can. That's for damn sure. Right. And that, I think on the one hand, right, like she does not go into Congress and say like, hey, Howard Kleinhandler and Julie Haller, why don't you guys line up and represent me? Like, no, she knows that the people she's co-counseled with in these various Kraken lawsuits are terrible, crazy lawyers. Mm-hmm. And when it's her ass on the line, she's gotten a real lawyer.
That is a good point.
Yeah. Point number two, people have found the magic fraction video. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Is it three is a magic number from Schoolhouse Rock by Blind Melon?
Is
they need
kind
that
of.
Kind of song for it.
It is attached to a website called hackingdemocracy.com. There was an HBO special on it, and the person behind it, and this is actually important, is a woman named Bev Harris. The Magic Fraction, The Hacking Democracy, focuses on early 2000s allegation about Diebold machines. Diebold was the machines anyway, and that division was purchased by Dominion Voting in 2010. And the site says, quote, the same hackable software is still inside it. And I'm sitting there thinking, 20 years later? I don't know. I don't know. That's all I can say, right? And we're going to, criticize a certain former mentor of mine on Tuesday's episode for not doing your research. I wouldn't claim that that's impossible, but I would claim that that would seem to require some follow-up research. But by far the biggest thing that came up, I mentioned to you that I had reached out to Clint Curtis, the person that Sidney Powell identifies by name in her January 6th testimony, and that he ran as a Democrat in Florida. And I thought perhaps that was going to be an indication that this was somebody who
wasn't nuts.
Yeah, hypotheticals were not. No, he is, as far as I can tell, completely crazy. And I take this from an Orlando Weekly article about his run for the House of Representatives in 2020. Under the headline, is this man crazy?
And this was the guy who was like, if you want to hack an election, I'll get you a toe.
Yeah.
With nail polish, right? And that guy who's like, I could definitely just hack it.
And this guy was a lifelong Republican until he changed parties to register as a Democrat to run against the guy that he thinks hired him to steal the election in 2004. It's not entirely clear. So there are, I've noted it as 8 kind of bullet points of maybe this person is not a trustworthy witness. Point number one is that the Orlando Weekly went out and they interviewed Bev Harris, right? So that is the person who did the Magic Fraction video criticizing election, the hackability.
What is the Magic Fraction?
Yeah, I don't know. I tried watching
one third out of one fourth. Which one? That's not important. I thought that was going to factor.
No. Bev Harris thinks Clint Curtis is crazy. So, this is an example, Sidney Powell, of sort of doing the like flat earth thing, right? It's like, as long as you are, opposing the model that has been validated by science, you're welcome in my tent, even if it's self-contradictory. So, Bev Harris says, the Clint Curtis testimony before the House Democratic panel does an excellent job of stimulating public imagination, but has a few problems of its own. Curtis's testimony assumed that Ohio's election had been rigged, though he admitted to never having studied the results. And because Feeney, that's the guy he ran against the Florida congressman, and because Feeney allegedly pitched the program 2 years before any South Florida counties used electronic voting machines, it would have been impossible for Curtis to know what specific types of software would be used in the future. Quoting Harris, You can't do one-size-fits-all software, Harris says, noting that Curtis isn't the only person to build a prototype that alters election results on theoretical vote-counting platforms. Yeah, like, you did that literally on the air, right? You're like, 10, if vote is for Biden, multiply by, right? Yeah, I can write that in BASIC for the Commodore 64, okay? Yeah. The only way the scheme would work, she says, is if Feeney, that's the Florida congressman that Curtis says paid him off to do this, knew which company was going to run the voting machines, then approached a programmer inside that company to write a vote rigging program that would work on those machines. It wouldn't make sense to call in some random guy, she says. It wouldn't even help. Okay, so point one, the two sources that Sidney Powell directs us to in her congressional testimony are pointing the fingers at each other, right? They each think the other one is crazy. Point two, Curtis's testimony is not what Sidney Powell says it is. On December 13th, 2004, when he testified at a panel of the House Judiciary Committee, Democrats investigating voter irregularities in Ohio, Curtis at first told them that his 2000 meeting with Feeney and the subsequent software he developed made him think Republicans stole the 2004 election. Yes, I would say it was. I mean, if you have exit poll data that is significantly off from the vote, then it's probably hacked. Okay, that was his direct testimony. A few minutes later, though, he backed off. Jerry Nadler asked him, to your knowledge, was this the vote rigging program used? I have no idea, Curtis answered. Sidney Powell made much of the fact that he testified before a congressional committee. That turns out to be true. But the reason that I didn't think that he had testified before that congressional committee is because that congressional committee on the 2004 election released its report January 5th, 2005, and identified, it was 102 pages long, and identified a whole bunch of voting problems in Ohio that, quote, resulted in a significant disenfranchisement of voters. That's typical, you know, Republican dirty trickery, right? Mm. And raised grave doubts about the election outcome. That report does not mention, I control left it, I went to the index, does not mention Clint Curtis. So, you know, the next point is that the House testimony was equivocal, and the House decided that they were not going to rely upon his testimony at all when discussing voting machines. Curtis says, well, I passed a lie detector test.
Oh, well, that means nothing.
Right, exactly. That means absolutely nothing. And the test itself, as the Orlando Sentinel points out, was paid for by an anonymous group investigating voter fraud. So, great.
So this is just some random nut making claims. He gets interviewed by some sort of committees and something, and then everything he said is just, well, I heard that or something. It's like just nothing. There's no actual substance. Okay.
And it gets worse. Oh. I only have six more of these. So Curtis published an on-demand book called Just a Fly on the Wall, which he published in September of 2004, as the Orlando Sentinel points out, this is pulling no punches, quote, poorly written and full of off-topic rambling and grammatical errors. Curtis makes his distaste for Feeney clear in the last chapter. Quoting the book now, this request to set up the vote tampering program was early in my exposure to Congressman Feeney, so I was not familiar with what a total piece of crap he was. So, look, we would say something like that on the show, but, you know, I love it. Okay, that last chapter, right, showing Congressman Feeney as a piece of crap is, this is kind of point four, what the Orlando Sentinel note says, one of Curtis's biggest credibility problems, because the last chapter is the one in which he describes the scheme to rig the 2004 election. But when Curtis first published the book, the chapter wasn't in there. And when asked about it, Curtis says, well, no one really cared back then. It wasn't as important as the espionage, right?
What?
The details of, like, stealing the software from it. Yeah.
Look, I'll be honest, man. I'm just a bundle of yarn right now. I'm just a full-on cartoon, like, mummy of yarn. What is happening? What is this? I can't. Yeah.
Having made allegations about the 2000 and 2004 elections, the Orlando Sentinel notes, that this means that Curtis went 4 years to go public from the time he says Congressman Feeney asked him to create vote rigging program and the time that he finally disclosed that. And that seems fishy. So another problem, this is point five with Curtis's story. The meetings took place in the fall of 2000 before Florida used electronic voting. The push for electronic voting didn't happen, of course, until after the 2000 presidential election, which had the hanging chads and the butterfly. Those were all non-electronic ballots. So that's why Florida switched over to voting machines so that they wouldn't have that again. I'm not even going to read. This was Curtis's prior employer filed a lawsuit against him for copyright infringement, deceptive trade practices, that they stole, that Curtis stole some of their software when he was working for them. And the former CEO says, he's a wacko. I just think he's a compulsive liar. Well, okay, former employer. We all have bad former employers. We maybe cross that one off.
Yeah, but this one tells a pretty consistent story. This guy's, if everybody and a newspaper is saying the same thing, you know, maybe there's something to it. Yep.
And then two more. This came from a Wired news article interview with Curtis, December 2004. Curtis didn't know that touchscreen machines were being used in 2000 until a reporter told him. So that seems bad. And then in the same article, a Johns Hopkins University computer science grad student who had previously authored a paper critical of security flaws in the Diebold election machines said there is almost no chance Curtis's code was used in any voting machine. So that student was Adam Stubblefield, grad TA. And Adam Stubblefield said, quote, Curtis clearly didn't have the source code to any voting machine, and his program is so trivial that it would be much easier to rewrite it than to rework it. So for those eight reasons, I will not be inviting Clint Curtis to come on the show.
You're not going to slide into his DMs?
Yeah, I'm gonna give that the old passaroo. So in attempting to save someone who I thought was being misrepresented by Sidney Powell, I did some further digging. And I still don't think, because, you know, he hasn't published anything about the 2020 election. I still, like, amazingly enough.
I'm sorry. I can't remember what all this even is. He's just a source that Sidney Powell cited?
Yes. This is Sidney Powell says, but you have to look at Clint Curtis. Yeah.
But all this is about 2004 and 2000.
Right. But remember, the same hackable software code is still inside those Diebold machines that are now Dominion voting machines. So
you got to follow the code.
And how that relates to the other Sidney Powell claim of, you know, Dominion voting was started by the ghost of Hugo Chavez in the 1930s.
Well, see, ghosts often recycle code as well. It's widely known.
It could be. So, it's crazies all the way down. That's okay. That's the end of that. I also wanted to do kind of a quick update. This was suggested by one of our patrons, and I thought it was really, really illustrative of what the Supreme Court does when they have crafted an opinion out of whole cloth in order to kind of lock that down. And this model also is true with DC versus Heller. And we've talked about how subsequent appellate court cases tried to use the, like, well, you know, it's not like we're talking about, you know, military issue hardware here, right, and the other, like, sarcastic language from Scalia to try and carve exceptions to it. The original Citizens United decision has a long analysis of, you know, balancing the governmental interests against the intrusion.
Sorry, the intrusion being any limits at all on spending on elections?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Big intrusion.
So Citizens United is 2011. This is a case that went up to the Montana Supreme Court in 2011, and it involved Montana Statute 13-35-227, which was enacted as a ballot initiative by the Montana voters in 1912, right? So citizens of Montana have been under this law for 100 years and, again, are, you know, small government conservatives just, you know, just calling balls and strikes. We're like, oh, hey, maybe I can overturn this 100-year-old law. And spoiler alert, they lost in Montana but got bailed out. Spoiler alert. But it got bailed out by the Supreme Court.
Yes,
and this story, I think, is really, really illustrative of what we mean when we talk about right-wing judicial activism. So the Montana law says a corporation may not make a contribution or expenditure in connection with a candidate or a political committee that supports or opposes a candidate or a political party. And there's some other stuff in the statute, but that's the big thing, right? Can a corporation still fund a super PAC? You betcha. Okay. So throughout this opinion, the Montana Supreme Court is like, yeah, what we're just saying is corporations may be people, my friends, but they don't have the same speaking through the political system that a flesh and blood person does. And the super PAC system, like, while it kind of sucks, at least requires you to make some disclosure requirements. Yeah. And so the effect of this law is to say, yeah, okay, one way in which corporations are not do not have all the same rights as human beings is they don't get unlimited electioneering, unlimited spending on behalf of their candidates. Why is this important in Montana? Because there are no cities in Montana, right? Montana is a rural state, and its elections until the past decade were basically like old-timey kind of elections, right? Like, they weren't dictated by money. They were dictated by grassroots activism. And so even in a state that's like, you know, you think of as being super Republican today, this nevertheless proven to be iconoclastic, right? It's elected Democratic members to the Senate and so forth. But, you know, you think of Montana, you're like, okay, right, you know, really rural conservative. That's also a tradition that they were trying to protect from overweening corporate influence. So Montana Supreme Court says the Montana law at issue in this case cannot be understood outside the context of the time and place that it was enacted. Right. During the early 20th century, 1912, Montana became a state in 1889. Right. So, I mean, literally, right, like first two decades.
And think about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And me neither. And again, notice that this is precisely what conservatives say they want to do. Right. Let's look at the history and tradition. OK. Montana becomes a state in 1889. 20 years later, 23 years later, the voters rise up, place a ballot initiative, and pass a law that prohibits unlimited corporate campaigns.
Back then, too. We don't want big buggy whip buying our election. I don't even know what.
Well, here's, it just so happens I know the story.
Railroad tycoon? Yeah. Oh, okay. Sweet.
Here's what happened. Those tumultuous years were marked by rough contests for political and economic domination, primarily in the mining center of
Butte. There you go.
Right? Between mining and industrial enterprises controlled by foreign trusts or corporations. These disputes had profound long-term impacts on the entire state, including issues regarding the judiciary, the location of the state capital, the procedure for the election of U.S. senators, and the ownership and control of virtually all media outlets in the state. And then it describes a fight over mineral rights between entrepreneur F. Augustus Heintz and the Anaconda Company.
Like Heintz is in the catch-up?
Nope.
Oh.
Different Heintz.
Sure.
I am sure. And the Anaconda Company, which, by the way, like, you know, if you're trying not to be evil, maybe don't call your company the Anaconda Company.
Yeah.
Cobra. Then controlled by Standard Oil. Right.
Jeez. So, this is like three comic book villains in a trench coat.
Right. That's exactly what it is. Heintz managed to control the two state judges in Butte, who routinely decided cases in his favor. The Butte judges denied being bribed, but one of them admitted that Anaconda representatives had offered him $250,000 cash to sign an affidavit that Heintz had bribed him. Not a great system there, right? So in response to the legal threats, in 1903, Anaconda closed down all of its mining operations, but not, as the Supreme Court notes, the many newspapers it controlled, throwing 4/5 of the labor force of Montana out of work.
Wow. That's like 8 guys.
you're getting letters. Its price for sending its employees back to work was that
you're
the
right,
governor.
Sorry. That's like 6 guys and 2 horses.
So Anaconda, losing to in front of these allegedly corrupt judges, shuts down all of its operations, unemploys 80% of the state of Montana, and then says, you'd like us to start back up work again? Well, it's 1903, so good luck with that. But
so,
tell you
so
what we'll
one
do.
One tycoon is like, I'm taking my economy and going home. Like, you can just shut down the whole thing?
Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
So its condition was that the governor call a special session of the legislature to enact a measure that would allow Anaconda to avoid having to litigate its cases in Butte. the governor did that. He called the special wow. section of the legislature, and that law is still on the Montana books today. We could do a separate story on that. We don't have time. Now, enter W.A. Clark, who the Montana Supreme Court notes, quote, had amassed a fortune from the industrial operations in Butte and set his sights on the United States Senate. In 1899, in the wake of a large number of suddenly affluent members, the Montana legislature elected Clark to the U.S. Senate. Because again, remember, this was pre-popular election of senators.
Oh, right. Yeah, yep. They just get appointed.
Yep. Clark, quote, admitted to spending $272,000 in the effort, which, again, that's $1 billion today. And its estimated expense was over $400,000. Complaints of Clark's bribery of the Montana legislature led to an investigation by the U.S. Senate in 1900. The Senate Investigating Committee concluded that Clark had won his seat through bribery and unseated him.
Wow.
The Senate committee, quote, expressed horror at the amount of money which had been poured into politics in Montana elections and expressed its concern with respect to the general aura of corruption in Montana, end of quote. I love, man, I wish I had clerked for the Montana Supreme Court because just you don't get Supreme Court opinions like this. Quote, in a demonstration of extraordinary boldness, Clark returned to Montana, caused the governor to leave the state on a ruse, and, with the assistance of the supportive lieutenant governor, won appointment to the very U.S. Senate seat that had just been denied.
Okay, what?
Yeah, this is supported by a book called Montana, An Uncommon Land, and the author is K. Ross Toole. It will not surprise you that I have downloaded a copy of Montana, An Uncommon Land. So I'm going to piece through this and try and figure out hey, governor, look yeah, over there.
Look over there. I'm the governor now.
No, so what happened now was, right, he tricked the governor into leaving the state and then had the lieutenant governor direct the state legislature to appoint Clark.
Well, how
Clark
does that work, though?
Back to this, I don't know.
There's several layers where I guess it's just like, well, politics were different in 1900 or whatever. So we have seen the modern equivalent of like the lieutenant governor running amok when the governor leaves the state. Remember that? What was that? I'm forgetting exactly the example. I can't remember which state it was, but there was that very thing. It's weird to think of that being a different party than the governor. But it can be, and so that still exists today. But the part where the governor can then order the legislature, who then, because it was pre-whatever amendment, can appoint senators, that's several layers of intrigue there. Okay. What a plot.
Yeah, this is not done. So Clark gets the lieutenant governor to engineer him to be appointed. Maybe it's a recess appointment because the seat was unfilled. I don't know, right? Like, but gets appointed back to the Senate seat that he was just expelled from. Then, of course, the U.S. Senate is like, we're just going to expel you again.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So he resigns and then engineers enough races for the Montana state legislature that he basically controls the Montana state legislature and gets sent to
infinite
the Senate
appointments
a third time, by which time there's no corruption at that point because the corruption is, or there's no provable corruption in the Senate because what he's bought enough of the Montana state legislature that he didn't have to bribe them directly.
Wow.
They're now all just his lackeys. So Clark went to the Senate, by the way. He finally got that thing that he greatly craved. I could continue. It's amazing. I'm going to go back to the Supreme Court quoting K. Ross Toole, the historian who wrote Montana, An Uncommon Land. And the Supreme Court quotes this in support of the proposition of the state of Montana was still contending with corporate domination even in the mid-20th century. The Anaconda Company maintained controlling ownership of all but one of Montana's major newspapers until 1959. Quote, today the influence of the Anaconda Company in the state legislature is unspectacular, but very great. It has been a long time since the company showed It has been a long time since the company showed the mailed fist, right?
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. But no informed person denies its influence, nor the fact that the basic use to which it is put is to maintain the status quo, to keep taxes down, not to rock the boat. Few of the company personnel in either Butte or New York remember F. Augustus Heinz, or even, for that matter, Joseph M. Dixon, but it would be foolish for anyone to deny the pervasive influence the Anaconda Company in Montana politics is part and parcel of the Montana heritage.
So basically, they lay in wait. They haven't seen the Anaconda, but they're still, it's buried somewhere and could at any time influence politics again.
So with that as background, in 1912, Montana was like, we would like not to have that. And this was a truly, you know, bipartisan effort that remains to 2011. Even small expenditures of money can impact Montana elections. So in connection with this case, the state of Montana submitted affidavits from two experienced politicians. Bob Brown, a Republican, served in the Montana House of Representatives, the Montana Senate, as Montana Secretary of State, and as an unsuccessful candidate for governor. He retired in 2010. Mike Cooney, a Democrat, served in the Montana House of Representatives, in the Montana Senate, as the Montana Secretary of State, and was also an unsuccessful candidate for governor. Okay, so pretty good, you know, bipartisan resumes there. Both affirm that Montana, with its small population, enjoys political campaigns marked by person-to-person contact and a low cost of advertising compared to other states. They affirm that allowing unlimited independent expenditures of corporate money into the Montana political process would drastically change campaigning by shifting the emphasis to raising money. By the way, that's true.
Yeah. Remind me where in the inception we are. This is the Montana Supreme Court in the case that eventually was slapped down by the...
By the Supreme Court. So this is 2010.
Okay. Pre...
Before...
Citizens United.
As Citizens United is being decided.
Gotcha.
Okay. So... Cooney, for example, ran his first state legislative campaign for $750. Brown affirmed that Montana politics are more susceptible to corruption than federal campaigns, and that infusions of large amounts of corporate independent expenditures on just media coverage could accomplish the same type of corruption in Montana politics as that which led to the enactment of the law in the first place. So I could keep going, I want to end with, you know, Clark, the guy who bought his Senate seat three times, caught the attention of Mark Twain.
Oh, nice.
In 1907 that Clark, quote, is said to have bought legislatures and judges as other men by food and raiment. By his example, he is so excused and so sweetened corruption that in Montana, it no longer has an offensive smell. Well, gotta love. They don't make them like that anymore. So the Montana Supreme Court says the question then is when, in the last 99 years, did Montana lose the power or interest sufficient to support this law, if it ever did? And that is essentially, I could go through the rest of the legal analysis, but basically they say, look, Citizens United says we are using strict scrutiny because it's free speech.
It's everyone's God-given right to buy an effing election. It's every corporation's God-given right,
to
buy an election.
And so Montana says, okay, let's play by your rules, Supreme Court. Here, our state compelling interest is very, very great because of this unique history, because these incredibly rural elections where you could be the most powerful man in the Montana Senate for $750, right? And we'd like to keep that the way it is. We'd like to keep our elections, people running around and having a drive out to, I can't name
a single other place.
Other than Butte, I cannot name a single other place in Montana. Sorry, Montanites that listen to the show. And so we have a very, very compelling state interest. And in terms of the restriction, this is really nothing. You can get around this by creating a super PAC and disclosing your donors. And so we think, fine. Citizens United says you apply strict scrutiny to efforts to restrain corporate spending. We think we've met that here.
Yeah.
Because it's bad in Montana. SCOTUS doesn't care.
Yeah.
And 5-4, you know, it's 5-4, even though it's a per curiam opinion, because there's a Breyer, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Kagan dissent back when we had four liberals in dissent and not just three, in a case called American Tradition Partnership versus Bullock, then the governor of Montana, 2012, in which the Supreme Court granted cert and summarily reverses in, I'm going to read you the entirety of the opinion. The entirety of the opinion is, a Montana state law provides that a corporation may not make an expenditure in connection with a candidate or political committee that supports or opposes a candidate or political party. The Montana Supreme Court rejected petitioner's claim that this statute violates the First Amendment. That's the case I just read you. In Citizens United, this court struck down a similar federal law holding that political speech does not lose First Amendment protection simply because its source is a corporation. Okay.
Yeah.
The question presented in this case is whether the holding of Citizens United applies to the Montana state law. There can be no serious doubt that it does. Montana's arguments in support of the judgment below either were already rejected in Citizens United or fail to meaningfully distinguish that case. Reversed. That's it. So notice again how unbelievably shoddy that reasoning is, right?
Yeah.
You can say political speech has its First Amendment protection. Lots of speech has First Amendment protection, but gets restricted.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But the goal was to allow corporations to buy elections. And so this opinion immediately cemented that as the legacy of Citizens United. We're not even pretending that it's a question of looking through and undertaking a serious analysis of does this violate strict scrutiny? No, it's just, yeah, Citizens United now stands for corporations can do whatever they want and you're screwed.
Okay, then.
Sorry about that.
Whereas something like the right to privacy and, you know, making medical decisions about your own body, that was just invented out of whole cloth. That was wrong from the beginning.
Yeah.
Even though there's just plenty of jurisprudence establishing that very thing.
Or, you know, if the local governing parties have so contrived to gerrymander your vote as to make it meaningless, the solution to that is to vote for different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should have thought of that before you were disenfranchised.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. It is really frustrating.
It's bad.
But that was a fun jaunt down some early 1900s memory lane. Good stuff.
I enjoyed it. I am more and more convinced following our buddy Larry Lessig that this really is a medium-term problem that has to be solved. There's always keeping the barbarians back at the gate, but this situation permeates our politics. The fact that 99% of House seats are safe one way or the other is what gives you your Lauren Boberts and Matt Gaetzes and, you know, encourages the craziest wing of your party to run and upset. Just something has to be done about our fundamentally broken system for how we elect people in this country.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. Thomas takes the bar exam. I think I aced the last one. Position still open for Andrew Torres hype intern, but we'll see.
Thomas, City College is funded by the county government of State X.
Oh, wow.
City College issues an email directive that all employees disclose all social club memberships at the start of every school year. The purpose of the directive is unclear. Most employees make the disclosure for fear of losing their jobs, but a college accountant challenges the directive as unconstitutional. Is the college accountant correct?
College accountant?
A, the college accountant is probably wrong. Such memberships exist.
What?
B, the directive is probably wrong. Social club memberships are a private right. C, no, the directive is probably constitutional so long as there is a connection to job performance. Or D, yes, the directive is probably unconstitutional if there is proven state action and it is wrongful.
What the hell? City, okay, yeah, city. I like, we got three different layers in one sentence. City College funded by county government of state X, but yeah, that's government, okay. City College issues an email directive, don't think that matters, that all employees disclose. So you have to disclose social club membership. So it's not banning anybody, it's just saying, and it's employees. Okay, so they are saying employees must disclose social club memberships. That doesn't seem that bad. I'm trying to think just prima facie here. If your employer is like, hey, just need to be notified of which social clubs you're in. Is that social clubs like at the college? What's a social club? I don't know. Rotary club? I don't know. But it also seems like a little invasive. I don't know. But I mean, we're allowed to drug test people to see what they do on their off hours. So that seems crazy to me. Okay. Purpose of the directive is unclear. Well, that seems like, you know, you got to have some. That is interesting, because no matter what test we're applying, it fails, you know, strict scrutiny, moderate, intermediate scrutiny, no scrutiny, you know, whatever it is, it fails if there's just no purpose. So that's weird. Most employees make the disclosure for fear of losing their jobs, but a college accountant challenges the directive as unconstitutional. Okay. Is that accountant correct? The college accountant is probably wrong. Such memberships exist. That's the weirdest answer. So because memberships exist, the college accountant is... I don't know. I mean, that is really trying to trick me if that's the correct answer. I don't know how... So A seems like nonsense, but who knows? B, the directive is probably wrong. The directive is probably wrong. What? So the question is... Is the directive unconstitutional? Not wrong. I don't know what wrong would be. How the directive is probably wrong. Yeah, it might be wrong, but so B, I feel like sounds like one that would appeal to a non-lawyer. It's like the directive is probably wrong. Social club memberships are a private right. Like, I love all that language, but directive is wrong? Can they just substitute wrong in for unconstitutional? That can't be right. C, no, the directive is probably constitutional as long as there's a connection to job performance. That's plausible to me because it's just disclosure. And as long as there's a connection to job performance. So that answer is stipulating that this meets some level of scrutiny, like intermediate, maybe. I can't remember what the first one is. Not much scrutiny. D, yes, the directive is probably unconstitutional if there is proven state action and it is wrongful. That can't be the test. Wrongful. So I don't like anything but C, really. This is a weird one. It just seems like a bunch of word salad. And the only one that hits, from my experience and assuming I'm applying the right tests here, the only thing that hits the actual test that I remember is C. D, yes, D starts out well. Yes, the directive is probably unconstitutional if there's proven state action. Okay, that seems fine. And it is wrongful, though, because that's not really, I don't think that's the test. Wrongful. State action is wrongful. Because you need to prove that there's state action and that there's not, it doesn't meet some sort of scrutiny, I think. Not that it is wrongful. Ah, boy, I really think every answer sucks except C. I don't know for sure. I think I'm between C and D. Those are the only ones that even mention the right things at all. So I'm between C and D, and I will go with C. And before we wrap up, we've had a lot of requests to have ChatGPT take the bar with me because this has been making waves. So I'm going to attempt this. I have not done this yet because, again, I never spoilers anything. So this is fresh. I'm just pasting it in here. We're gonna react live. I don't know anything. This is my first time using ChatGPT. I assume, Andrew, we can just pop the multiple choice in there and it will use one. Well, whatever. I guess the test is ChatGPT needs to know what to do when I paste in a bar question. So we'll just say whatever. I've pasted in the question and the answers. Let's see what happens. It's going to take the test along with me.
All right.
All right. Well, here's what ChatGPT had to say. We'll throw this into it's Thomas and ChatGPT takes the bar exam this week and we'll see who's right and who is dead. It is possible that the directive is unconstitutional if there's proven state action and it is wrongful. Well, that's interesting. So that's adopting the wording of D, but it goes on. State action refers to the actions of the government or a government-affiliated organization, and if the city college is funded by the county government and is issuing this directive, it could be considered state action. Okay, I agree with that, and that actually sounds like very cogent writing. I don't know. The directive may be wrongful if it violates the employee's right to privacy or freedom of association. Okay. It is also possible that the directive may be constitutional as long as there's a connection to job performance, but this would depend on the specific circumstances and details of the directive and how it is being implemented. Without more information, it is difficult to accurately assess the situation. You and me both, ChatGPT. So here's the thing. I wanted to see if I could make it choose an answer. So I just typed in, like, I edited the question to say choose one of the answers. And it chose D. Yes, the directive is probably unconstitutional if there's proven state action, and it is wrongful. So, yep, that was my second choice answer. So I would say odds are really good that ChatGPT is acing this one, but you'll have to decide, everybody. Andrew, tell them how they can play along.
Yeah, if you want to play along, just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. I cannot stress how important that is. That's how I find people who are participating. Give us your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Enjoying all the goodies. The ad-free episodes. We're back to the 4-episode-a-week schedule, so that means even more ads you're not hearing. So jump on patreon.com/law. And Andrew, why don't you start us off?
Michael Palazzio, Lulu Dickey, Leonard Trammell. Hey, Leonard, thank you. Ryan Hanlon, One-Eyed Nick, became an OA subscriber because A, episodes keep getting cut off. I think that's been fixed. B, I like the show. C, for the math. Or D, all of the above. Love that. Sam Cunningham, Aaron, Marsha Formica, Dana Schwartz, AC, Chips Currency. I put chemicals in my punch to turn the freaking Yuletides gay. That's amazing.
That's really good.
Jordan and Jordan Faye Watkins, take it away, Thomas.
Thank you to Violet with interesting Violet with like E-T-T-E. Jinx Greymoon, Nathan Grange, Austin, Kevin George, Astro Otter, Client Intake Specialist. The intake is bourbon. I've listened to the entire catalog 3 times. No way. Is that true? Write us back. That's like 7 lifetimes. I don't know. How is that even possible? But wow. Congrats, or I'm sorry. I don't know what to say, but that's woof. Sanchito, James Tipman, Maya B, Jared Ratoff, and Elizabeth Eddy. Thanks so much for pledging, everybody. Hope you enjoy the goodies. And that's our show, Andrew. I'm excited to see if I can beat a bot at the bar exam, and I'm betting on no right now, but we'll see.
Me too. Let's find out.
Wait, you're also betting on no? Or no, you also can't wait.
I also can't wait.
Okay. I thought, good. It would really sway the betting markets if they found out how you were betting, so you can't do that.
We call that insider information. Yes. Yeah.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.